Chapter 7 of the Assault on Mount Everest, 1922. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Prajakta. The Assault on Mount Everest, 1922 by various authors. The Attempt with Oxygen by Captain George Finch. Chapter 7, The Second Attempt. With the departure of the last of our companions on March 27th, Crawford and I found ourselves left behind in Darjeeling, impatiently awaiting the arrival of the oxygen equipment from Calcutta. A week elapsed before we were able to set out for Kalimpong, where we picked up the oxygen stores on April 4th. On the evening of our second march out from Kalimpong, suspicious rattlings were heard in the cases containing the oxygen cylinders. On investigation, it transpired that they had been packed metal to metal, and the continual chafing caused by the rough mule transport had already resulted in considerable wear in the steel. This dangerous state of affairs, which, if not speedily remedied, would undoubtedly soon have led to the bursting of some of the cylinders, with consequent demoralization of our transport, let alone possible casualties, called for immediate attention. So, throughout the night of April 5 and 6, Crawford and I, aided by our porters, worked steadily at grommeting the cylinders with string and repacking them in such a manner as would render impossible any recurrence of the trouble. On April 8, in a snowstorm, we crossed the Jelepla, thence proceeding via the Chumbi Valley and Fari, we ultimately rejoined the main body of the expedition in Kampazong on the 13th. The rest of our journey across the bay to the base camp has already been described elsewhere, but perhaps I may be permitted to give a few of my own impressions of the country and its inhabitants. In recollection, the strange land of Tibet stretches itself out before me in an endless succession of vast, dreary plains broken by chains of mountains that, in relation to the height of their surroundings, sink into the insignificance of hills. Arid and stony desert wastes, almost totally unblessed by the living green of vegetation, interminable tracts of sand that shift unceasingly under the restless feet of an ever-hurrying, pitilessly cruel wind, bleak, barren, and unbeautiful of form, but fair and of indescribable appeal in the raiment of soft glowing rainbow hues with which distance, as in compensation, clothes all wide open spaces. Sunsets provided many a wondrous picture, while towards the south of glistening array of white-capped excrescences marked the main chain of the Himalaya. The honor of being the most poignant of my memories of Tibet, however, remains with the wind. It blew unceasingly, and its icy blasts invariably met one straight in the face. The pre-monsoon wind is westerly, the post-monsoon wind blows from the east. Our journey towards the base camp led us towards the west. Homeward bound, during the monsoon, we traveled east. Both going and returning, therefore, we marched in the teeth of a wind that gnawed even at our weather-beaten, hardened skins and was the most generous contributor in the quota of discomforts that Tibet meted out to us. And what of the dwellers in these inhospitable plains? Like all humankind, the Tibetans have their bad as well as their good points. The former are easily told. If one wishes to converse with a Tibetan, It is always advisable to stand on his windward side. A noble Tibetan once boasted that during his lifetime he had had two baths, one on the occasion of his birth, the other on the day of his marriage. Those of us honored by his presence found the statement difficult to believe. Apart from this rather penetrating drawback, the Tibetans are a most likable people, cheery, contented, good-natured, and hard-working. Slow to give a promise, but punctilious to a degree in carrying it out. Truthful and scrupulously honest. As testimony of this last mentioned trait, be it said that during the whole of our long wanderings through Tibet, when it was quite impossible to keep a strong guard over our many stores, we never lost so much as a single ration biscuit through theft. Old age is seldom met with. It is exceptional to see a Tibetan whose years number more than 55 or 60. Presumably, living in so severe a climate at an altitude of 14,000 feet or more above sea level proves too great a strain upon the human heart. The priests or lamas, as they are called in Tibet, constitute the governing class. They represent the educated section of the community. The monasteries are the seats of learning and, as such, are well nigh all powerful. I regret to state that I did not like the priests as much as the laity. The reason is not far to seek. If you wish to hold converse with a lama, it is advisable not only to stand on his windward side, but also to take care that the wind is exceptionally strong. The lamas do not marry. As 2/5 of the able-bodied population of Tibet led a monastic life, it will be readily understood that the odor of sanctity is all-pervading. In other respects, the monks proved as attractive as their simpler countrymen. Inquisitive with the direct and pardonable inquisitiveness of children, they are nevertheless men of a distinctly high order of intelligence. Kindly, courteous, and appreciative of little attentions, they were always ready to lend assistance and to give information concerning their religion and the manners and customs of their country. These few of the more lasting of my impressions would be incomplete without mention of Tibetan music. On the assumption that whatever is beautiful, Tibetan music is beautiful. To the Tibetan, to the Western ear, it is elementary in the extreme and in point of view of sheer ugliness of sound, competes with the jarring, clashing squeaks, bangs and hoots of the jazz bands that were so fashionable at home at the time of our departure for India. On May 2nd, the day after our arrival at the base camp, Stroot, Norton and I were sent off by the general to reconnoiter for a suitable first camping site near the exit of the East Rongpuk Valley. Gaining the latter by the so-called terrace route, which leads over the tremendous moraines on the right bank of the main Rongpuk Glacier, we had no difficulty in finding on the right bank of the East Rongpuk stream, but a few hundred yards west of the end of the East Rongpuk Glacier, a favorable position for camp number 1. We returned that afternoon, descending down the snowed over and frozen up stream to the main Rongpuk Glacier, making our way thence to the base camp through the trough leading down between the glacier and the moraines. With this little exertion, my climbing activities ceased for the time being. Soon afterwards, I was beset by a troublesome stomach complaint, which had already claimed as victims the majority of the other members of the expedition, and it was not until May 16 that I was sufficiently restored from the wearing effects of my illness to resume climbing. In spite of this, my time at the base camp was fully occupied. Frequent oxygen drills were held and all the oxygen stores overhauled and tested. Various members of the expedition were instructed in the use of primus stoves. There were many small repairs of different natures to be done, and in my leisure moments, I was kept busy with matters photographic. In addition, Mount Everest and the weather conditions prevalent thereon became objects of the keenest study and interest. The remark, I suppose Mont Blanc would be absolutely dwarfed into insignificance by Mount Everest, has frequently been made to me in one form or another, and to my questioner's amazement, my answer has always been a decided no. As a matter of fact, Mont Blanc, as seen from the Brivon or Fligere, excels in every way any view I have ever enjoyed of Mount Everest. It is true that I have seen the latter only from a tableland, which is itself from 14,000 to 16,000 feet above sea level, and that I know nothing of the wonderful sight that Mount Everest probably presents to the observer from the southern Nepalese side. The grandeur of a mountain depends very largely upon the extent to which it is glaciated. Mont Blanc is nearly 16,000 feet high, and its glaciers descend to within 4,000 feet of sea level, a vertical zone of 12,000 feet of perpetual ice and snow. Those glaciers of Mount Everest, which flow north and thus the only ones with which we are concerned, descend to a point about 16,500 feet above sea level. A vertical zone of 12,500 feet of perpetual ice and snow. Thus, it is evident that from the point of view of vertical extent of glaciation, there is little difference between the monarch of the Alps and the northern side of the highest summit in the world. From the point of view of beauty, there can be no comparison. Seen from one quarter, Mont Blanc rises in a series of snowy domes piled one against the other in ever-increasing altitude to a massive yet beautifully proportioned and well-balanced whole. From another side, we see great converging granite columns breathing the essence of noble purpose, proudly supporting and lifting aloft to the sun the gleaming snowy capped splendor of summit dome. Another viewpoint, though revealing perhaps a less beautiful Mont Blanc, lacking much of the graceful symmetry and strong purposeful design of the other views, is redeemed by the fact that the observer is forced in so close to the mountain that the rattling din of stone falls and the loud crash of the ice avalanche are always in his ears. Mont Blanc asserts her authority with no uncertain voice. In the Mount Everest, as we of this expedition know it, revealed in the full glare of the tropical sun, all this is lacking. Symmetry and beauty cannot truthfully be read out of the ponderous, ungainly, ill-proportioned lump which carries, as if by chance, on its western extremity, a little carelessly truncated cone to serve as a summit. Avalanches are neither seen nor heard. Falling stones there are without doubt, but one is too far off to hear them. Yet Everest had her moments. Diffused with the borrowed glory of sunrise or sunset and clad in a mantle of fresh snow, the harsh clumsiness of her form would be somewhat softened and concealed, bathed in the yellow-blue light of dawn, as yet unkissed by the sun, but whipped into wakefulness by a driving westerly wind that tore from head and shoulders the snowy veil which she had donned during the night, rendering it into long, spun-out living streamers, no beholder could gainsay her beauty. Weather conditions naturally proved of the greatest interest. On consulting my diary, I find that during the period from May 1st to June 5th, there were 2 days when the weather was fine and settled, and that these 2 days succeeded snowstorms which had thickly powdered the mountain with fresh snow. On both days, the sky was cloudless, or nearly so, and judging from the absence of driven snow dust about the summit, Mount Everest appeared to be undisturbed by wind. Apart from these 2 occasions, however, the weather was never absolutely fine. Cloudless skies there were, but the great streamers of snow smoking away from the highest ridges of the mountain testified to the existence of the fierce and bitter wind against which a mountaineer would have to fight his way. On 4 occasions, there were periods of snowstorms lasting from but a single night to 3 days and 3 nights. On May 10, Mallory and Somerville set out for Camp 3 to make ready for a first attempt to climb Mount Everest. I had practically recovered from my stomach trouble and expected to be able to leave the base in the course of a day or two in order to follow up the first attempt with a second attack in which oxygen was to be used. Norton was to be my companion. Unfortunately, however, I suffered a relapse and Strutt, Norton and Morsehead left to join Mallory and Somerville, whereas I had to resign myself to several more days at the base. At length, on May 15, I was ready and eager to think about doing something. My climbing companions were Jeffrey Bruce and Lance Corporal Tejbir, the most promising of the Gurkhas. Wakefield was to accompany us as far as Camp 3 in order to give us a clean bill of health from there onwards. Leaving the base on 16th, we proceeded to Camp 1, where the following day was spent attending to our oxygen apparatus and transport arrangements. Soon after midday on the 18th, we arrived at Camp 2, where the greater part of the afternoon was devoted to giving Jeffrey Bruce, Tejbir and several of the porters a lesson in the elements of mountaineering and of icecraft. On the 19th, we reached Camp 3, where we learned from Colonel Strutt that Mallory, Norton, Somerville and Morsehead had gone up to the North Col in the morning. Jeffrey Bruce and I immediately set about overhauling our equipment, in particular our oxygen stores, and as we worked, we could see the first party making their way through the seracs and climbing the ice cliffs of the lofty depression of the North Cone. The cylinders containing our oxygen were found to be in good condition, but the apparatus, through no fault of the makers, who had indeed done their work admirably, leaked very badly, and to get them into satisfactory working order, 4 days of hard toil with soldering iron, hacksaw, pliers, and all the other paraphernalia of a fitter's shop were necessary. Our workshop was in the open. The temperature played up and down round about 0 degrees Fahrenheit, but inclined more to the negative side of that irrational scale. The masks from which the oxygen was to be breathed proved useless, but by tackling the problem with a little thought and much cheerfulness, a satisfactory substitute was eventually evolved, making it possible to use the oxygen apparatus in an efficient manner. Without this new mask, no real use could have been made of our oxygen supplies, oxygen would have been misjudged as being useless, and the solution of the problem of climbing Mount Everest would have been as distant as ever. Preparatory to embarking on the climb itself, we went for several trial walks. One, over to the Raipiola, a pass 21,000 feet high at the foot of the northeast ridge of Everest, from which we hoped to obtain views of the country to the south. But only part of the northeast ridge showed hazily through drifting mists. Towards the north and looking down the East Rongbuk Glacier, views were clearer, though partially obscured by rolling banks of cloud. Colonel Strutt and Dr. Wakefield, unoxygenated, accompanied us on this little expedition, and oxygen at once proved its value. So easily did Bruce and I outpace them. On May 22nd, acting on instructions from Colonel Strutt, Jeffrey Bruce, Wakefield, Tejbeer and I, with a number of porters, set out for the North Col to meet and afford any required assistance to the members of the first climbing party who were on their way down from the mountain. It was also our intention to bring stores up into the North Col as well as give the oxygen apparatus a final severe tryout prior to embarking upon an attack upon Mount Everest itself. We met the first climbing party just above the foot of the final steep slopes leading up to the North Col. They were more or less in the last stage of exhaustion, as indeed men who have done their best on such a mountain should be. After supplying them with what liquid nourishment was available and leaving Wakefield and two porters to see them back to Camp 3, we carried on up to the North Col. In the afternoon, we returned to Camp 3. There had been a considerable amount of step cutting, for fresh snow had fallen, compelling us to deviate from the usual route, but even so, oxygen had made a brief alpine ascent of what is otherwise a strenuous day's work. We took 3 hours up and 50 minutes down with 36 photographs taken en route. End of section 15.